Welcome to the in-person people. Welcome to the online people. It's so nice that you can mix and match and still manage to come along online if you can't make it in person, which is just really great. So we're on our second last class of this course, Becoming Your Best Self. Hopefully that it's hello, welcome, come in, hi, come sit wherever you like. It's going to be a class relevant whether you're Buddhist or not, whether you're religious or not. It's still because we all have our, commonalities as human beings. So what we've already covered in the course, a wide-ranging amount of topics. We've looked at what happiness is because, of course, we all want to be happy. None of us wants to suffer. We've looked at the eight worldly concerns, all of the things that distract us from happiness and that corrupt all of our best intentions. Then we looked at the three higher trainings, which are the essentials that we need to be able to not get corrupted, not get distracted, actually be able to really follow what's meaningful to us. Does anyone remember what those three higher trainings were? What the three essential skills for a human being? Oh, concentration. Yes, that's right. That's one of them. What else? Remember the analogy, the person with the two arms holding the axe, chopping the root of suffering. So concentration was the two arms holding the axe. And what was the axe? Wisdom, that's right. The axe that cuts through confusion, the darkness of ignorance. And what was the third one that we needed? Ethics, that's right. Embody our ethics. Can't just subscribe to ethics or believe in ethics. We actually have to live it, walk the talk, embody it. And then last week we looked at then the symptoms of having disturbing emotions, of having distractions, otherwise known as anxiety and depression. So with our with the anxiety and depression, the thing to remember about them is even though they're really unpleasant, they are a symptom that something's wrong, and they show us where to look to heal ourselves. So do you remember the analogy of that, of the symptoms? What else is something that's unpleasant but a symptom and very helpful? Pain, that's right. We actually need to have pain in order to be able to protect our body. And if we go to the doctor and we don't have pain, they can't even figure out where the problem is. And when you go to a hospital, I've been watching all those emergency shows, and they ask you, like, what's your level of pain and where is the pain? And if you can't tell them, they're in real difficulty. So our depression and our anxiety are emotional pain. They're our emotional pain system. So for that, they're crucial, but we need to learn how to listen. So for those of you that were here last week and had a chance to do the reflection sheets, did anyone give them a go? Or did you have any questions or anything that came up from last week from what we talked about? Because it was a pretty intense dive into the, you know, the common problems of our age, isn't it? So how did you go? Questions, comments? Just
the reflection sheet is quite useful. Good questions.
Okay, good. So that sounds like you actually did it, which is really excellent. So, I mean, a lot of it was fairly easy and really things like just diet and sleep patterns and things. So were they useful or just more the inner reflection?
Yeah, and also listing, you know, the things that make you that you worry about most? Putting them in some kind of list.
Yep.
Yeah.
That helped put it in its box. Oh, good.
And then, but then I got anxious. I thought I should be worrying about something more.
And there is the habit of worry right there. It's like when we've solved all of our, you know, immediate problems, it's like, oh, what's going to happen next? That's the habit of worry, ready to go. It's its own momentum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great, good, because we'll have a look at that very thing, the momentum of worry tonight. Who else? Questions, comments about last week? Okay. Well, let's have a look what we'll do today. So we're going to have a look at the neurology of a habit pattern. How our habits actually develop blow by blow. What each of the components of that cycle, to identify each of those components. When we look at that cycle, you'll see how come negative habits just seem to develop themselves. We don't have to concentrate. Now, concentrate on being angry or concentrate on being resentful. You know, don't let your mind fall off. Just they drive themselves, don't they? So why are the negative habits so strong? Why are they difficult to break? And how come we have to put so much effort into developing positive habits? And so then we'll also have a look at, apart from the toxic negative habit cycle, look at the positive habit cycle. So a cycle of flourishing. Where do we start? Because if we want to break our negative habits, you can't just rely on willpower alone. And this is usually what we do. We make a New Year's resolution. We determine, okay, I'm gonna beat this thing. And we might actually have a lot of energy to start with and willpower. And we might be smarting in the background from, you know, something that's happened. We might be driven also by regret or fear. But that'll wear off. And we'll just fall back into our default habits. Also, if it's just willpower alone, that takes a lot of energy and it needs constant maintenance. And then if we lose our energy, so if we get sick or if some other life emergency happens that takes all of our time and our focus, we won't have the energy for that and bang, we'll be straight back to that old habit pattern. So willpower is a good start, but it's certainly not the way to make really lasting change. So we need to have some strategies. So we'll have some Buddhist strategies, how to deconstruct negative habits, how to undo them. And then also we don't want to leave a void. It can be very helpful to replace negative habits with something positive because we have a momentum and we are, you know, going about in the world having our life. So instead of just stopping everything, we can use that momentum. So it is possible to dismantle the negative ones, to develop positive habits so that they actually become part of us. And then naturally, then whatever happens to us, we'll respond in a good way. And so then we'll trust ourselves. We'll become trustworthy. So let's just do a short reflection to set our motivation for the day, for the evening. So even just settling our posture for meditation is a really good habit because it helps us to focus our mind in a gentle way without kind of slamming into the wall. So just adjusting your posture so you're comfortable however you're sitting, and then adjusting your spine so that your spine becomes relatively straight, and doing this in a gentle way by imagining a fine golden thread of light running up the center of your body, just in front of your spine, coming out the crown of your head, and feel as if you're being pulled upwards from your crown. You might notice that you sit back a little bit Your head should just slightly tilt forward and pull the chin in. Just have your hands resting lightly in the lap or on the knees, and pull the shoulders back a little bit so that the chest and heart area is open. Take a couple of deep breaths, let out any stale air from the lungs, and then just let your breathing be normal and natural. You don't have to change it in any way. And relax the jaw, put a slight smile on the lips. Rest the tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. And let your eyes just be lightly closed or even slightly open so some light comes in. And release any tension from the temples, the forehead. Become present in the room. Notice how you're sitting here. Still and quiet. The rest of the world is still going on around us. So too, bring your focus just to the breath. Just anchor your attention to the breath, the easy rising and falling of the breath. And anything else that is going on in the mind, just leave it in the periphery. Leave it be. Put it aside without getting involved. And instead just having your focus on the breath. And you can say in and out as you're breathing, if that helps to just focus your attention on this one thing. And often when we do just focus on the breath, there might be a whole lot else going on in our mind. So instead of getting involved in the details, just notice a name. Notice it a thought or a memory, an emotional sensation, a physical sensation. Just name the category. The air temperature, a sound, whatever it is, notice, name, and bring your focus back to the breath. And even if you have some internal dialogue going on, just put it aside, just ignore it. If it's really important, it'll be there afterwards anyway. And let your mind become still, just like autumn leaves begin to settle once the wind has stopped. And then let it become apparent to you how come you're here tonight. What's the main thing you want to change or discover? The most important thing. And use this as our starting point for the purpose of the meditation, which is to deal with, of course, these immediate issues. They are enough to actually give us the impetus to come here to class. But then expand your motivation, expand your purpose as far as you can. Why are we here? To overcome not just this problem and that problem, but the very cause of all problems. to cultivate a lasting happiness, to bring a peace of mind to ourselves, and then to be able to share that with others. And from that state of equanimity and confidence, be of the best benefit to the world that we can. All the way up to complete liberation from cyclic existence and full enlightenment or awakening for the benefit of all. So stretching our mind all the way to this great vast purpose. Then a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. Bring your focus back to the room. And let's have a look, get started on habits. So what actually is a habit? Oh, let me see. So any kind of habit is something that's an acquired behavior. So it takes a little while to develop a habit, but anything that we do repeatedly and then becomes involuntary or automatic, so that we do it without actually needing to think about it anymore. So habits can be, you know, neutral. It's just the power of repetition. So a negative habit is something that is not just obviously destructive, but it's something that also takes us away from positive things. So that's quite a deal more subtle than what we normally think of. So we probably know whatever our own destructive habit patterns are. We've identified a few at least, but it's a little bit more to recognize, oh, okay, all that time that I spend procrastinating, or all that time that I spend, say, obsessively doing housework, not that that happens anymore, but it did back in the day, takes me away from doing something that really matters, that's really important. So usually we start identifying those because it's time wasting. And if we were asked, oh, okay, we've only got a year to live, would you be doing those things? We'd probably say no. So a negative habit is not only the destructive ones, but takes us away from something beneficial. So let's see. In a way, why do we develop negative habit patterns? It's just through familiarity. And because we are hardwired or primed to look at the differences and the negativities and the dangers to ourselves first as an instinctive imperative to stay alive, then because they get our attention first and foremost, it's very easy to develop trauma, to develop negative habits, and to obsessively focus on the negativity. We don't have to put effort into that. That just happens naturally. And then the power of familiarity kind of drives it. So evolution-wise, it's kept us alive, but it hasn't kept us happy. So if we actually want to develop some sense of peace or calm to enhance our living environment, then we've got to put some effort into a positive habit. So often what will happen with traumatic things that have happened to us, it just takes a couple of times or even one time, and we revisit that trauma in memory. And in a way, that plays it through again. So that actually becomes our practice. The event is long gone, but various circumstances or things will trigger us and we'll relive that memory. And that the memory and the experience of that trauma becomes a habit. And we think it's the trauma. We think it's that thing was the problem, but that's been and gone and finished. And we are a different person now than then. So what's happening is we are practicing our fear and practicing our trauma. And the thing is that if we don't do anything about it, it doesn't go away by itself. In fact, what happens with habits, if we just leave them be and brush them under the carpet, they get stronger. That's their natural thing that happens. So everything that we've been, and this is what really scared me, everything that we've been putting off and putting aside and hoping will go away by itself is actually just growing the whole time. So ages ago, there was that show on ABC, Grumpy Old Women and Grumpy Old Men. Did anyone ever see that? It was hilariously funny and had lots of, you know, wisdom in there. And there was a bit of bonding over various social suffering. But, you know, no one actually sets off to become a grumpy old man or a grumpy old woman. I know when I grow up, I want to be a grumpy old woman. That doesn't happen. No one sets out for that to be, and yet it happens again and again. But if you ask those people, did you intend to become a grumpy old man or a grumpy old woman? They go, no, I'm just deeply unhappy. So this momentum propels us for years and decades, and we keep on putting it off. It actually, you know, starts, I think many times people will just say, oh, they're going through a stage, terrible twos. And then it's, you know, later on, then it's whatever, you know, teenagers and hormones. And then whatever, it's then, oh, you know, the stress of study. And then, oh, it's a midlife crisis. And then it's, oh, grumpy old man, grumpy old woman. And all the way along, we've been practicing these negative ways of being till they become part of us. So the question is, what are we practicing right now? That makes us who we are. Our habits end up defining us. We certainly don't set out to be annoying or to be grumpy. And yet, actually, if you know someone who's annoying or grumpy, you know, that's all encompassing. That's how you think of them, isn't it? So where does that come from? It comes from habit. So years ago, when I was still drinking very, very heavily, this is what I noticed with myself, that, and you know, I drank gallons of vodka pretty much as a way of self-medicating, you know, to deal with the world and my life and all of those things. And for a long time, it worked. I was a happy drunk. I was very entertaining, and everything was fine. But after a decade or so, as alcohol starts becoming toxic in your body, then all the drawbacks started coming out. And then one day I realized, oh my gosh, I've turned into one of those scary drunks. That's me. I'm one of those people that sits down at the bus stop and everybody stands up and moves away. Like, it finally dawned on me, oh my God, I've turned into this other person. You know, no one sets out to do that. But our habits, how we act, what we practice, it ends up defining us. So I thought what we could do was have a look at the habits for unhappiness that we set up, and then look at habits for happiness, what we can replace them with. So these habits for unhappiness, and again, remember that happiness and unhappiness aren't things that we get, are they? Or they're not things that happen to us. They're what we practice. So Buddhists are very good with checklists, with lists of things. And so for our habits for unhappiness, we've got a list of 10. And the first one, the worst physical habits that we can have, killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. So those three become habits. Then there are the lesser things that are associated. So instead of outright killing, for instance, instead of, you know, not necessarily killing human beings, but say glee in hunting down and killing animals. With stealing, we may not commit huge fraud or embezzlement. We mightn't have a Ponzi scheme going, but when stealing is very small, it normalizes it and it becomes a habit. So there's been lots of studies with you know, all the stockbrokers and things when all of the trading shares went berserk before the financial crash. So that all got out of hand because slowly how outlandish it was became more and more normalized. So it's kind of like lobsters boiling in a pot, you know, you don't realize that it's happening. The habit normalizes it. And sexual misconduct as well, which is, you know, cheating on your partner or with somebody else's partner. But there's a whole lot of also not necessarily sexual misconduct, but really sexually destructive practices with the explosion of pornography online. So most teenagers these days learn about relationships and sex from pornography. I mean, if that's not going to ruin you, I don't know what is. It's a real tragedy. So that's just from habitual exposure. Then we have the next door thing. So aggression. No one likes physical aggression. That's why I put this picture up here, because we all hate it, even when someone's pointing at us, you know. If someone's going, hello, welcome, it's much nicer. But if we get pointed at and pointed at, we feel it like a physical blow. But there are negative habit patterns also of overeating or oversleeping. I know when I've been depressed, I've just slept, part of it from exhaustion, but part of it from just how to switch off. Self-harm, alcohol, or, you know, aggression towards oneself, aggression towards others. So in terms of physical habits for unhappiness, if we are doing any of these, we're setting up an environment for us to be unhappy. Of course, as well as harming others too. So any questions or comments about this one, about the physical ones? Yes, Gerald.
Smoking.
Oh yes, smoking, that's right. So smoking is that's a tricky one too, because the immediate experience of it is an apparent benefit. You know, like many, I know when I was studying, smoking was kind of helpful for that because it helped me focus.
When I was trying to give up on smoking, I discovered Mark Twain made a famous quote. He said, giving up smoking is easy. I've done it a million times.
Giving up smoking is easy. I've done it a million times. That's right. And so what it does, why it's such a destructive habit, is that even in the short term, it may seem beneficial and helpful, but it takes you away from something beneficial in that it shortens your life and it harms others too. Yeah, so I've got friends who've got cancer from passive smoking. I mean, that's just tragic. Okay, then the verbal habits, the verbal habit of lying, very similar to the verbal habit of stealing, that just by becoming familiar with lying, it makes it easier to do bigger lies. So people who lie in the workplace, lie about, you know, being late or taking a sickie or whatever, then it's just, if we don't watch out, it gets more exponentially. So then you lie about more things until it's rife. And then it makes it much more likely that there's corruption in the whole workplace. Then hurtful or harsh speech that really harms others. So that can be really aggressive yelling when angry, but it can also just be like casual racism, casual misogyny, all that stuff that people go, ha, 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 you know, can't you take a joke? I didn't mean it, but it actually, they're harmful words. They hurt others. So we can tell if it's hurtful, harsh speech by whether we cause harm to others. It's not whether we reckon like, oh, I have a right to swear or I have a right to say whatever harmful thing I want. It's actually from whether it causes harm to others or not. So the next door thing of, say, sarcasm, for instance, sarcasm can be quite funny and witty. But if you're on the end of the brunt of sarcasm, it's really hurtful. So what makes it harsh is the fact that someone is hurt. Also, when I was a raging drunk, many of my friends swore like troopers, like pirates. In fact, swore incredibly creatively. And so in that environment, you'd have swear offs, you'd have swear like a pirate day, you'd do, you know, all of those things. It was really, really funny. But when I came to Lungri Tungpa Centre, oh my gosh, it was a real, I'd be saying things and then I'd look and there'd be the horrified faces of the people in front of me. I'd go, uh-oh, I said something inappropriate again. So it's how it lands on the other's ears. Slander, of course, you know, speaking behind people's back, really being divisive, hypercritical, you know, critical without any help, and then just gossip. So gossip, those four things in that first dot point, gossip or meaningless speech is in there as one of the habits for unhappiness, because we just tend to degenerate. If we're having a good old gossip, we very rarely end up inspired to save the world. We usually just end up bemoaning politics, the state of the world, getting really anxious about everything and really, really down. So I just recently had a conversation with my father like this, because he's like raging left wing. And so whenever we talk about politics, it's like straight to the catastrophe. And so now it's kind of become a bit of a running joke of like, oh, yeah, we'll just have a nice conversation. Now we're back in the calamities again. So we'll just leave that for a moment, because it just becomes so depressing making without it being helpful. Crack a joke, come back to it later on. Other verbal habits, nagging. Online trolls. You can probably think of a whole lot of other ones. If you watch TV, often you might have a running commentary going in your mind, especially when you see stuff on the news and you're going, oh, the idiots, or oh, I hate them, or not them again, or be tempted to throw something at the telly, or, you know, that kind of negative habitual response. If we do that with our speech, then it sets it up much more likely to do it physically. We're creating that kind of inner environment. So actually controlling these two, our physical expression and our verbal expression, we can do it. It just takes that little bit of discipline and we can do it. We can be nice. We can be kind. Even if what's going on in our mind is just berserk, we can still do something about these fairly easily. And I remember it, a teaching when Venerable Robina was here in person, and someone was really, really unhappy and really down on themselves. And Venerable Robina is quite direct. So she's saying, now look, have you killed anybody? And the girl's like, no. She's like, Do you lie and steal? She's like, no. Do you swear at others? Do you talk behind people's backs? No. She says, well, you're already a successful human being. What's your problem? Like, oh, okay. If you put it like that, then yes, actually, if you manage to refrain from these things, you are already an awesome, a successful human being. And it is relatively easy for us to refrain from these things because our environment, so, you know, peaceful and conducive to it. We're not, you know, in a war, and we're not in a disaster zone, and we have all of this kind of opportunity to be able to refrain from these fairly easily and supported. Okay, so questions about the verbal habits? Questions, comments? Yes, tell me your name.
Al.
Al, right. What?
Like pain, starvation, racism, inequality.
Yeah.
All these things. Like, there's a lot going on in the world. So how can you, I guess, have the inner peace but still fight for people who are abused?
Yeah, that's right. For the vulnerable. Things. Yeah.
Like, there's a lot going on in the world. You can't just close your eyes.
That's right.
Living your own little peaceful.
But you've just said it already. how can we have the inner peace to be able to do it? So that's really just like
still
you said, the key.
Still be like, I guess, strong and still speak up and help and like.
Well, that's the tragedy that often what's happened to us is that we've been too scared to speak up. And when we do, the only way that we do is with aggression. So it comes out wrong. It's a real tragedy that we have to rely on hurtful speech or aggression to get our point across. So there are trainings where you can learn the difference between assertiveness, which is inclusive, which brings people along with you, which is friendly, and can be forceful as well. Like you might need force, but there's kindness there. It's driven by kindness. But often the only time that we're really forceful, it's when it's married with aggression. So much so that we can't even imagine being strong or forceful without it being aggressive. So this is the thing, that these habits, they're so ingrained in us, of being aggressive or yelling or to get our point through being really hurtful, that we can't even see that there is a way to do it in a strong way that will actually land well. So, I mean, we see the long term of this, that when you ostracize anybody and leave them out, you might be able to, for a short term, change things, but in the long term, it's just going to be worse for everybody. So we really have to bring everybody along with us. And the only way we can do that is if we have some inner peace first. Because if we don't, then what comes out, even if we have a passion for social justice, what will come out is hurtful speech or harsh, you know, harsh speech. So this leads us to then the mental habits, what our mental environment is like. So the three worst mental habits are covetousness or craving what other people have. That thought where you go, oh, I just want what other people have. That's like the kind of the baseline covetousness. Ill will or malice, resentment, wishing harm on others. And who do we normally wish harm on? Those who've hurt us. So that immediately perpetuates the cycle. And wrong views. So though that wrong views or distorted views underpins both of them. So on a very coarse level, wrong views are things like racism, sexism, any form of prejudice or bigotry. And so a lot of those wrong views are cultural. Like you might have grown up in an era where girls didn't do maths and girls couldn't play sport and boys couldn't cry and it was demeaning if boys did housework. So all of those things, you can see they're wrong views because they're distorted. They're out of step with reality and they end up being really harmful. From a Buddhist point of view, though, wrong views is far more profound, which is that view of me and mine that is so solid, thinking that we are independent from others, thinking that there is a real me that needs to be defended and made everybody to respect, you know, and so that sets up a duality between us and them. So all of our problems actually stem from that. And there are attitudes that kind of drive it. So the attitude that goes, it's not my fault. Whatever happens wasn't me. It's not my fault. It's somebody else's fault. There's the attitude of never feeling that we have enough. No matter what happens, it's not quite good enough. We still need more. Things are going great. Having an excellent party, everybody's there, great, now let's have more to drink. It's the just like we've associated having more with happiness. So that when we're happy, the next thing that we want is more, instead of actually being able to relax and enjoy whatever's happening. Or the thought, I'm no good. That Venerable Rabina very clearly blasted out of the water. So, you know, with our training in ethics, that's those two, the physical and the verbal, how to embody our ethics, and it's supported by our mental attitude. Any questions or comments about the mental habits for unhappiness? Are you all a bit depressed now? I mean, this is the thing, I look at this list and I think, okay, I've got all of them. So then it's like, no wonder I'm not comfortable in my own life. No wonder I don't have a natural confidence, or no wonder I'm intimidated. So these are all kind of indicators that we have these habits for unhappiness going on. Questions? Yeah, never enough. That's
the most insidious one.
Mm.
Because you always think, I just need a little bit more money in the bank account just to feel comfortable.
Yes, that's right. Just a little bit more money in the bank account. And that's the one when, you know, in all the movies when the criminals go, just one last job, you know, and you know, don't do it. Don't do it. You have enough. Yeah, or you just work yourself into the ground. How much is enough? So we think how much is enough is an amount, but actually it's an attitude.
Yeah.
It's the capacity to feel what I have is enough. Yeah.
There's a really good Dolly Parton quote about
that. I love Dolly.
See if I can remember it, about if you're so busy making a living, don't forget you. Yeah.
Yes.
That's a misquote.
We've got the gist of it. Yeah, and Dolly is someone who certainly embodies it as well, isn't it? She really walks the talk. She gave all of those that million or so donation for the developing of a COVID vaccine. Mm-hmm. And it just came out accidentally and people discovered. So let's have a look then. Okay, so habits, they were habits for unhappiness. Now, what about happiness is also a habit? So this is something we forget. This great quote from Paul McKenna, who's kind of famous for being a hypnotist, but also we've got quite a few of his books in the library, kind of evidence-based psychology. So he said, happiness is nothing more than a few simple disciplines practiced every day. While misery is simply a few errors of judgment and bad habits repeated every day. So in terms of how our day-to-day life goes, this is the crux of the matter. That with a little bit of discipline, some of the, you know, the three high trainings, some concentration to remember to do it, we can put in place habits for happiness. And when we look at our misery, so much of what's miserable every day is because we've been practicing those, you know, physical, verbal and mental kind of destructive activities. So when we look at it like that, happiness isn't a thing that happens to us. Happiness is an activity. If we want to be happy, it's an activity. That's the key. And so if we actually cultivate the virtuous minds, the opposite of the ones on the previous slide, if we become more familiar with those, then what happens is when life changes, when we're caught off guard, it becomes more likely that we'll respond in a positive way rather than retaliate or rather than be reactive. So that will naturally come with training. So in the beginning, it's effort, 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 effort. But then there comes a stage with a little bit of mental training where you can rely on yourself. That if someone's really rude to you, you're not going to automatically be rude back. You're not going to throw it back at them. But if someone's really rude to you, you'll be able to have the confidence that you know you're not going to make it worse. And then not only that, but it'll start becoming second nature to go, wow, what's wrong with them? Where's the suffering? What's going on? That'll become your natural response. So that's possible to do. So if we can do that, that's what's called baseline natural realistic optimism. So we, to get to that baseline, we change our habits rather than kind of waiting around for happiness. So here's just a few to get you started. So the gratitude journal as a way of changing our, what do we have, the three of them? The habits of the mind. So instead of having those negative habit patterns that just, you know, that we ruminate on, that gratitude journal, some of you might have done it from that first class. It's a way of changing our focus. Yeah, Gerald. Right. And you've got it in your wallet, your list. Right. Yeah, right. And so it reminds you, are they things that would normally come to mind, or the list is a useful?
Beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, so it reminds you of those things. Yeah.
Yeah, so all those things, like I say, 79 different items on there, things that I have to be grateful for, and God,
yep. There you go. And you didn't have to buy it, and you didn't have to wait around for it. All you have to do is just whip your list out of your wallet. So case in point. Huge one. And so that's a habit in itself. So yeah. because we don't naturally gravitate, remember all those good things, we need a prompt.
Yeah.
And so as a strategy, very, very good. Then a physical thing to do. I think there's a movie, Pay It Forward, isn't there? Really tearjerker, amazingly inspiring movie. So it's such a great idea, this, to pay it forward, especially when something good happens to us, instead of thinking, oh, great, now I need more, to actually go, okay, I'm going to pass this goodness on. I'm going to pay it forward. It's a really wonderful habit to set up. And it also means that, you know, when really good things do happen to us, instead of us just getting like survivor guilt about it, which can happen and we ruin our happiness, we can think, great, enjoy it, fantastic, and then pay it forward, share it with somebody else. So as a physical thing, and giving compliments. So just as a way of creating a virtuous habit of our speech, compliments really go a long way. Just a smile and a compliment. It takes a bit of presence of mind to give compliments, but it's really worth it. It does make a huge difference to people. And whilst we're on the glass half full or the glass half empty, here's the Buddhist take on it. Technically, the glass is always full, but it's our perspective, isn't it? Half air and half water. So it is clearly what we make of it. And, you know, with COVID, there's a case in point, isn't there, especially for Lungri Tungpa Centre. So it could have been catastrophic for this centre, suddenly no classes, you know, in person. But we were able to take all of our classes online, and it was a huge effort on my part, because like I was saying to you before the class, you know, I'd never actually been to a class online, and here I was having to lead classes online and set up the whole system and figure out which platform to use and what equipment and which cords and, oh my God, what's going on, and lead a class all at once. So, you know, for the first 5 or 6 months of COVID, I'd see on Facebook or the news all these people that were like in lockdown, on furlough, all this time on their hands doing TikTok videos, and I'm going, where's my COVID holiday? Because I'm just spending like 12, 18 hours a day on the computer every single day figuring all this stuff out. And it was incredibly intense. And of course, because my office is the bed, so I was just in bed with the computer and all the papers and all the cords and everything. And I stayed in bed for 8 months. And then Then I got out of bed and I went to come upstairs to Lungri Tompa Centre and I couldn't get up the stairs. I actually had muscle wastage and it's taken me like 6 months to stop puffing to get back up the stairs. I thought, oh my God, this chronically ill people, this is what happens to them. It was a real shock. Anyway, but that's the glass fully full, right? There is a silver lining there and it's incredibly beneficial for Lungri Tompa Centre. And it could have gone either way. And so I'm not minimising, it was a huge amount of effort to be able to actually find the benefit in that. But it's there, it's palpable. And I can walk again, it's okay. Here's the other one that I love, the optimistic pessimist. Nothing really matters, so I may as well be happy. And I really love this one because I remember when I was really suicidal when I was about 19, and luckily I kept a journal to write it all down. And after pages and pages of writing of why I wanted to die and then kind of asking why and then coming to the conclusion there is nothing to live for, and the very next thought was, well, therefore there is nothing to die for either. So I may as well stick around and see what happens. And that was the reason I didn't kill myself. So this is, you know, a more kind of using reasoning and logic to really get through difficulties. We make our own meaning. Okay, so let's have a look at the neurology of a habit cycle. How do these habits eventuate? So this originally came from a book called You Are Not Your Brain, by neurologist Jeffrey Schwartz, but I've added in the Buddhist take on this and also then the Buddhist antidotes. So the whole cycle we can think of as feeding the monster, the negative habit patterns, and as we go through, you'll probably recognize each step along the way. So what happens, we have whatever input comes in. So normally what we call this is we're triggered, isn't it? We're triggered, something elicits a feeling, usually one that we dislike, but it's an input and it can come in either from hearing a song, walking along the street and smelling popcorn and thinking about going to the movies, from a memory, from emotional sensations that arise, from a sugar rush, a sugar crash, whatever it is, all of this input, it's sense data and emotional sensations. And immediately that happens, we have an experience of we like it or we don't like it, pleasant or unpleasant. And this we can think of actually as a deceptive brain message, because if something is unpleasant, we immediately think it's bad and don't want it. And that's a mistake. It may or may not be bad. Just because it's unpleasant doesn't mean it's bad for us. And if something's pleasant and we like it, we think, oh, it's great, I want more. And that also may not be right. So these are, they're deceptive. We believe what the appearance, so not the visual appearance, but how we first experience something, we think that's true and that's it. We totally believe it. So I'm not sure if I said this last week or to which class I said it to, but sugar cravings. Has anyone here had sugar cravings ever? Okay. So do you know when you have a sugar craving, what do you want to do? Eat sugar. So that is a deceptive brain message. Do you know why? No, not because you shouldn't eat sugar, but when you crave sugar, physiologically you are low in protein. So that's the deceptive brain message. So when you want sugar, actually you should go and have some protein. But we just believe the appearance and go, give me more sugar. So, of course, the fast food companies have manipulated this so that they've got the whole lot. So that you you're craving protein, you go and have some protein that has a whole lot of starch, so then you crave sugar, so then you go and have some sugar, then you crave the next thing, and so then you just keep on buying all the stuff in the shop. And it all works because it's a deceptive brain message. So I put a little picture of an alarm clock there because there is this alarm. Because we like or we dislike it, we have this urge then to do something about it, to relieve the discomfort. So if it's a sugar rush, we're going, give me some sugar. And if we can't get some sugar, we get agitated. We get obsessive. Or if it's, say, an unpleasant emotional sensation, if a sensation of sadness arises in our mind, it feels unpleasant, so we go, I don't want it, and we push it away, we push it down. Or our partner says to us, oh, Miffy, we've got to talk. And go, no, now's not a good time. Don't want it, push it away. So this is the kind of, it's a reactive thing. We have an urge to relieve the discomfort. And of course, if it's a deceptive brain message, we're going to be in trouble. So we do whatever the thing is, the automatic, habitual, unhealthy response. So you get all agitated, you have a cigarette, woohoo, feel much better. The distress is momentarily relieved, that's for sure. But it is an unhealthy response. So this kind of shows us that we can't underestimate the power of this, of our automatic responses, because they do bring us short-term relief. Having sugar does bring us short-term relief. Or saying, no, now's not a good time to talk about it, does give us some space and relief. But it puts off the problem. And what it does is the negative brain circuits are strengthened. So we associate calming down and focusing with a cigarette. So many times I've heard of people who've given up smoking and they've been fine until something's happened, like they've just survived a car crash or something like that. And then the first thing, they get out of the car crash, I'm alive, quick, give me a cigarette. It's just immediately associated. So many people start smoking again from that kind of situation where we've associated a short-term relief of distress with that destructive thing. With drinking, with alcohol, and the thought of wanting more, what happens is we need to relax to de-stress. So we have a drink and we feel better. We do relax. And so that feeling of relaxation becomes associated with the alcohol. And if that becomes more and more prevalent, what happens in the end is that then, not only when we feel stressed we want to drink, but when we feel relaxed, because relaxation is associated with alcohol, if we actually feel good and relaxed, our first thought is, I want to drink. They get associated together. So it becomes a vicious circle, gets tighter and tighter. So then eventually you end up craving a drink when you're happy. So questions, comments? Yes, Gerald.
After having given up smoking, I went up to the group who were all smoking one day. And I went up to the group and I said, I thought I'd come up and enjoy some passive smoking.
Oh, yeah. Did you enjoy it?
And one of the smokers said, I reckon passive smokers ought to be made by their own.
Yeah, well, when I gave up smoking, I just followed smokers around for the first year.
Yeah.
It was a hard one. Really difficult. What else? Anything need clarifying? So this cycle, you can see it can happen almost instantaneously, this whole cycle, or it can happen within the space of half an hour or a day. So what can we do about it? When we're trying to break a negative habit, often we'll jump this cycle, we'll, you know, go right towards the end, but it's actually worth trying to do it in order and recognize where we are in this cycle. So how to, and you might notice we are deconstructing the habit cycle. We're not forcefully breaking it. We're not beating it into submission. We're just going to unpick it and undo it. So if you undo it successfully, then that negative habit's no longer there. Then you are free of smoking. It's not going to be there waiting for the circumstances. So how to actually deconstruct the negative habit pattern and have a cycle of flourishing instead in the input, changing that input to being proactive about it. So instead of waiting for stuff to happen to you, whether you experience happiness or unhappiness, to actually set your motivation in the morning, to set the direction for the day first, before the rest of the day sets it for you. So we can't stop thoughts arising in our head, but we can direct them. We can decide how to interact with them. We can't stop all of the input. We can't change the way people talk to us very successfully. It's a long-term proposition. You know, we mightn't be able to stop the jackhammer next door with the neighbours doing renovations, interminable renovations. I remember when we were in Newmarket and it was like the entire suburb was renovating their house. It was just constant racket the whole time. So you can't change that input, but you can change how you respond to it. And the best way is to really set a good motivation, your best self motivation. Why am I alive? What's the purpose of my life today? So is there, does anyone here do some form of motivation in the morning? Yep. Long, short?
Kind of a Buddhist-y one. It's just like a little prayer.
Yeah.
Sometimes I expand on it because it's got, you know,
Buddhism. That's right. It's like a concertina. You can expand.
And I find, even though, like, when I used to go to the center, you know, everyone would say really fast, I find actually more meaningful when I actually sit there and
think through the layers. Yep. And, like, yeah. Associated. So usually
that can take me, like, at least 5 to 10 minutes
to say my
motivation.
That's great. You know, that's a good amount of time. So a 5 or 10 minute motivation in the morning is really good. And yeah, any kind of prayer, or if you're not into prayers, even a poem, something that you don't rush over, just kind of lip service, but say it and let it kind of sink in. And if you are familiar with it, then it does sink in and you kind of contemplate on it. So I found actually the best way for me to set my motivation is sitting in our garden. I really like that. And I think of world events because they kind of bring it a little bit more personal somehow. So it's very easy to go, oh, yada, 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 all sentient beings. But if you go all sentient beings, including those in ICU with COVID, or including those, you know, I was thinking just recently that Mardi Gras and everybody who's been before, you know, everybody who gave up their lives and went through untold danger, so that, you know, so that LGBTQIA++ can feel safe. So that's come at great expense. So just thinking about that, all sentient beings, that includes all of these people.
So I try to, like, well, it's really easy, then I do myself.
Okay. Yeah.
Easier. And then once I've done myself, then I start to do like
going to others,
and then I try to do different people, and then the whole world. And that's why it takes so long.
Yeah, and we have to be, we've got to go through the workings like that to actually make it real for us. Yes. And actually, we're going to spend a little bit of time on that next week too, how to develop that genuine sense, starting from, and you use that word too, of using being triggered in a positive way, triggering our kindness and our compassion. So again, we can use that a habit pattern in a positive way. And that's part of this motivation. So this we can all do before the external world crashes down on us and before all of our internal habit patterns of anxiety and depression crash in on us as well, before that. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche has even said, you know, even if you are undergoing depression, for instance, when you set your motivation, you can determine, today I'm not going to let depression cloud my judgment. I'm not going to let depression overwhelm me. I'm going to use the depression to develop compassion for others. So even then, you know, we make it real according to what's happening to us. And then when something happens, then with the like or the don't like, that's when we, all of our mindfulness practice kicks in. Pause. Yes, Gerald.
Just another thing I thought I'd share too. In my wallet, I also carry a little pamphlet that says, just for today. And it's got about 10 different items that are all very positive. That just for today, I'm going to do. And I do it.
Just for today, because just for today is doable, isn't it? Yeah, so that too is an excellent habit. Because often when we're trying to change, we'll go, I'm never going to do the negative thing ever again, and I'm going to do this from here on. So, yeah, the motivation, we've got to bring it back to a doable thing. But then with the mindfulness, so when something happens, an experience, our mindfulness should kick in to notice and name, here's an unpleasant feeling. Here's an unpleasant person. And if you want to stretch it out a bit more, you can add the words, how interesting, just so that you don't, you know, get reactive. So the thing is to make a pause between the experience and reacting to it. So normally with something that we like, we immediately grasp towards it. And we want it, so we're engaging in it. Even just a daydream, it's like, that nice little thing, and we're off we go. And if something is unpleasant, we immediately don't want it. And we push it away, and that's also engaging in it. Not wanting something and pushing it away is identical as if we just dived headfirst into it and grabbed it. Because the act of pushing it away, I don't want it, panicking, don't like it, is actually engaging in it. So whether we try to fulfill a desire or push against a horrible feeling, neurologically the process is the same. We're engaging with the urge. And if we do that, then temporarily we relieve whatever discomfort, but at the expense of fixing the cause. So with this, with a little bit of mindfulness, just pause. Use all of your smarts. This is just a deceptive brain message. How interesting. Notice a name and create some space before reacting. And Gerald, similar to what you said of just for today, you can go, yes, but not yet. Just not yet. So whatever it takes to create some space. And often, if we can do that and we haven't engaged in that thing, the urge, that sensation, it'll build and then it'll pass. And that's it, it's done. The whole rest of the cycle doesn't happen. So we remain with our equilibrium. You know, internally there's some stuff going on, but we can go about our day. We're not kind of being reactive, and emotionally we're stable. So again, any kind of mindfulness meditation before you leave the house is very good, because it will help you then have that as a resource for the rest of the day. So then the urge to relieve the discomfort, then some discipline about acknowledging those feelings without engaging in them. So not trying to block them out, not trying to block negative thoughts out, not running towards the thing that you're obsessively wanting to do, but having some discipline of a time lag. So restraint, 15-minute rule of thumb. Sugar cravings, 15 minutes. Yelling and retaliating at someone, 15 minutes. So that urge. So it doesn't mean not saying anything about it, but it means if we are just retaliating, often it just comes out all wrong and we're not putting across the message that we want to. So if we can have some discipline to refrain from just being reactive, everything can calm down. Then we can respond in a way that we actually want to. So then when you do act, you do so really mindfully with your full attention. So if you are then going to eat some Tim Tams, don't watch telly and browse your emails at the same time. Sit down with the Tim Tams and do nothing else but eat those Tim Tams and enjoy every little bit. So you do it wholeheartedly. Whereas most of the time, I mean, one of the things that people said for losing weight is to just eat together and don't do anything else. I mean, it's so simple, isn't it? So that's that, where we need a bit of discipline in there. And the good thing about this one is that the whole time that we kind of like trying to refrain from doing whatever, that discomfort is evidence that you are rewiring your brain. That's actually evidence that it's working. So that's another thing that you can say to us, that feeling inside, that the only way I can describe is going, that is evidence that you are actually rewiring your brain. The work is being done. Just like when you're lifting weights and you feel the burn, that is evidence that it's working. If you're just going, oh, this is easy, nothing's happening. Okay, so then with when we are just about to bust out, then instead of going to the negative habit, change the channel and do something else that's positive. So this is known as like just distract yourself. This is what people do with kitties. You know, kitties screaming, go, oh, look at this, darling, and they shove something else in their face to distract them. So it's what we do as adults too, but maybe not quite as obviously. And often this is the first thing that we do to try and distract, you know, to break a negative habit pattern, is we just distract ourselves. We don't do the other two things first. So while it will mean that we're not doing that negative habit pattern, it's not going to help us break that habit pattern because we haven't done the previous two steps. But it will certainly help keep us out of trouble. That's a good thing. And sometimes when the whole cycle and we're triggered and it's already happened, you can't undo it. Once you've got the adrenaline flowing through your system, you can't undo that. So then you have to go with it. And this is where we need a plan. What are you going to do to change the channel? And you may even need to have a new thing in your wallet, Gerald, of like, oh yeah, when all else fails, this is what I'm going to do. Put on some really loud music and dance like no one's watching. Or have a bath, chockers full of magnesium, or, you know, whatever it is. People go for a run. Or instead of smoking a cigarette, have a really delicious apple. Or a glass of soda water or something or other. When I was giving up drinking, then I'd have my tonic water and I'd have my fisherman's friends. And, you know, you associate drinking and smoking, right? So I figured out that what I could do was have my cold drink of tonic water and a fisherman's friend, and then you just get like this immediate ice cream headache kind of drawback experience that kind of subsumed the need for a cigarette. And so I'd be there, and I was like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, just giving up smoking. But it worked. And so for years and years, wherever I went, I just had my fisherman's friends there. So that's what I'd have instead of a cigarette. And they're so disgusting, right, that you can't actually scoff the whole packet. So you can't have nice lollies. You've got to have fairly disgusting ones that you'd only have one, but it does the trick. So you've seen that ad, haven't you, where the guy takes the fisherman's friend out and this wet fish just slaps him on the face like that? It's pretty much the effect. Anyway, so you change the channel, whatever it takes. When we're already triggered like this, it's called being in the refractory period. So talking about it is not going to help. Anything that anyone says will just make you want to do that negative thing even more. It's not going to help. So if you must talk about it, then at least walk and talk. Go for a walk somewhere around the block and then talk about it. But you've got to change the channel. Even just a very simple thing of getting up and going into another room, changing the physical environment. It's a real kind of life hack. So when you're changing the channel, it's important that the thing that you replace it with is enjoyable. You've got to like doing it. It's not a punishment. You're not there like punishing yourself for being bad. It's got to be something that you like doing, but it also has to be long-term beneficial. So it can't be just drinking more vodka because I might like doing it, or I did like drinking, but it's not long-term beneficial. So it's got to be something that you know you love, that you're passionate about, and that at the very least doesn't harm. So my go-to thing now is crochet. And I know that it works because when I was on hold to Telstra for 90 minutes, as we've all had an experience like that, haven't we? And the things that go through your mind and the utter helplessness and rage at being told, no, sorry, you can't get NBN in Camp Hill. That you're just like, right, I'm just going to go and crochet. And, you know, within a few minutes, I'm calm, I'm happy, I'm peaceful. The endorphins are flowing around because you're doing something with your hands. My focus has been on, you know, three stitches of that and two of that. So I haven't been able to think about those horrible people over there. And it all works. So it's debatable whether we need more crochet in the world. So I don't know if it is long-term beneficial, but it's certainly not harming anybody, right? So when this happens, you have to have it set up. You've got to have your list of things that you're going to do, because when you're triggered, that's when you go blank. You can't remember any of it. That's when you need to have Gerald's list. Whip it out of your pocket. So then if we have this, then we get a positive cycle. Our brain circuits are strengthened in a positive way. All of our skills will grow. We'll see some success. Like I'll actually have some success of releasing all of my frustration from doing crochet with Telstra. And then I was actually able to think about, oh, yeah, that's right. I used to work in a call center too. I know what it's like. Oh, those poor people. Luckily, I didn't swear at them, you know. And so you kind of come back to yourself again. So then when your skills grow, it becomes more likely that in a challenging situation, you'll have a positive cycle. All of your goodness will be triggered, not your trauma, your goodness, all of your qualities. And you'll go, goody, this is something I can really get my teeth into. And so then, of course, what happens is that then the input, your motivation, will get stronger. So I think our task is to recognize, to have some kind of awareness of where we are at any time in that cycle and apply the appropriate antidote. And certainly don't just go straight to changing the channel. Even if, say, with the discipline of refraining from the negative action, they say even just a few seconds between the urge to do something and doing it will help, even just a few seconds. So, handy hints, things to remember. A habit doesn't go away by itself. What a habit does by itself is just get stronger. And that's why we're so familiar with our destructive habits. It's just through familiarity. It's not what you think or feel that matters, but what you do. So remember that neurologically, whether we're panicking and going, no, 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 don't want it, or whether we're grasping, going, give me more, I really want this, I can't live without it. Either way, we're engaging with the thing. Think of it as the emotional sensations coming and going. Even give up on the urge to do something about it. So just think, oh yeah, I can sit with this. Don't have to do anything about it, just sit with it. Just like we talked about last week, yes, pain is unpleasant, but it's also important. It's a warning, something's wrong. But of course, what happens when especially painful emotions arise, we just want to get rid of them, don't we? We just put a band-aid on them, want to not feel them anymore. But that doesn't actually fix the cause of them. And even if we can distract ourselves or, you know, change the channel or do something else, that pain is still there underneath. So all of those emotions that come up, think of them as emotional signals. They're telling us something and something that we can pay attention to. If we block them, especially the painful ones, what happens is we block a whole channel of our psyche, of our emotional kind of a whole layer. So I noticed this with my mother, Inta. So she started this center. She was a refugee from the Second World War and, you know, from Latvia. And so there was they dealt with the Nazis and they dealt with Stalin and they had, you know, it was a lot of secrets. And there are a lot of secrets in her family, and that she had a lot of secrets. And just by keeping those secrets and keeping that pain buried, there was like a whole strata of emotion that just never came out. So very, very private. And I thought that was just, you know, like me and her mother and daughter kind of relationship. But actually, when I went to Latvia, it's a whole national characteristic. The entire country is emotionally secretive. Is really, really, it's like you're talking to the people and they're layers, layers, layers back. Very, very far back. And then I started noticing, oh, so maybe that's why I'm really secretive too. Because of that, it's a national characteristic to dealing with a national pain of going through a war. And, you know, then the kiddies of the people who've gone through a war just pick up all of those emotional habits without even knowing what's happening. So if we have the courage to feel whatever those emotions are, the unpleasant, uncomfortable ones, also the craving ones, the anticipation and the wanting, and just sitting with them, treat them as emotional signals and dive in deeper, paying attention, then we'll still be able to have that wealth of emotion. And don't give up what you want most for what you want now. So this is this thing. We always go for the short term, don't we? The short term relief. And it really is at the expense of the long term. So a lot of our things that we get obsessive with, that we spend our time just so much just on social media, or watching telly, or, you know, how many hours. It's kind of fun, and it's the bottomless bowl kind of experience that we keep on wanting it, but it eats away at our precious time as a human being. So this is just a little thing too. From Lama Yeshe, from this great book, The Peaceful Stillness of the Silent Mind. So he says, no matter what sort of mental problem you experience, instead of getting nervous or fearful, sit back and relax and be as silent as possible. In this way, you will automatically be able to see reality and understand the root of the problem. When we experience problems, either internal or external, our narrow, unskillful mind only makes them worse. When someone with an itchy skin condition scratches it, he or she feels some temporary relief and thinks the scratching has made it better. But in fact, the scratching has made it worse. And we are like that. We do the same thing every day of our lives. Instead of trying to stop problems like this, we should relax and rely on our skillful, silent mind. So I hope this has been helpful. The negative habit cycle of, you know, feeding the monster, and how to kind of stop feeding the monster by dismantling it, tackling each one of those steps along that cycle. And to remember that, you know, happiness is a habit. So we can use the power of habit to become happy. We can use the power of being triggered to become, you know, our best self. And the power of actually meeting misfortune and meeting destructive people, or to actually trigger all of our wisdom. So that when we're faced with difficulty or with difficult people, that automatically brings out our best self. It automatically brings out our good qualities. So if we can do that, then of course we're going to feel confident, naturally confident, courageous. And that comes from practicing it, putting in place these good habits. So we've come to the end of the night. Any last questions or comments before we dedicate the merits? Anything at all? Sink in. Yeah, it takes a lot of focus to get it. I actually think if you've got the notes, just print out that little slide and have it as your wallet pocket thing to just check, where am I up to here? Because that's where we started, just recognizing what's happening. While the whole thing might be a maelstrom, just to recognize what's happening, that's enough to start with. Because even then, the minimum that happens then is that we're not 100% overwhelmed anymore. Now we're a watcher seeing what's happening, and that gives us some relief. So, yeah, Gerald.
I should have mentioned when I was at it, on my list of things to be grateful for, studying Buddhism.
It's on the list. Yeah, well, that's the thing. Also, rejoicing or being grateful, it doubles your happiness. Yep. So let's dedicate. Let's dedicate the merits. Take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth, and rejoice in your efforts, and think how wonderful to have this opportunity to really work on our mind and on everything that brings lasting happiness for ourselves, that sets us up to be a good person, to be able to save the world, and how yes, it takes effort and concentration and focus, and that can be exhausting, but it's an incredibly good investment. So feel really happy with your efforts. Acknowledge how important that is, how it's quite rare to spend the time these days like this. Feel really happy about all the efforts of your fellow students. And dedicate all of this energy, this positive energy, to being able to bring this about in our life and deconstruct every single negative habit that we have because they're not us, and bring forth all of our good qualities for the benefit of ourselves and every other living being. So thank you, everyone. Next week, we're going to have a look at putting it all together as a daily practice. So there's going to be a couple of meditations and a how to structure it, motivation, what do you do during the day, and dedication. So great. So Tracy, how are you tonight? How are you going?
I'm really good. Yeah, thank you. That was a great class.
It's enjoyed it. It's a lot to put into one class, I am aware.
Yeah, but it sounds like next week we'll get to go over it all again and put it into a sort of practical format to follow.
Yeah, that's right, an actual thing to do. That's right. Yeah, and there's a really nice meditation actually called Stepping Into Your Best Self as well. So we'll have a couple of short meditations like that.
Awesome, because that's where I'm really slack is I keep thinking, yeah, I really have to do meditations. Oh, I'll just go and do this first and then I just never get back to it.
No, I'm like that too. So I've got some prayers that I say in the morning, and they're helpful because of the structure of them. But just like a on-purpose sitting meditation, I hardly ever do. There has been times in my life where I have, but probably because most of my contemplation now comes from putting the classes together. I do a lot of thinking, and so it happens that way. So it's got to happen in some way, but it doesn't necessarily have to be formal meditation.
Okay. That's good to know.
So let's see. So, Anne, a lot to process with the two cycles. You're right. Did you at least get the cycles, Anne? You kind of got the gist of them?
Absolutely. And what really stood out for me is I've taught a lot of this stuff for years, but it was really good to be an infant and learning it and, you know, like fully participating. And I put in there, there's been extras that have come through for my morning practice so that I just don't get stale in what I'm doing. You know, like I've got that on a roll and it's good, but having some extras to put in there to include, like, really setting that motivation and not just, oh, yeah, I'm dedicating for others, yada, yada, you know, here's my mantras, you know. So that's been... I didn't expect to get that, and that's like a little extra surprise.
Oh, good. I'm glad because, yeah, it is quite easy as things start being on autopilot to just kind of it's almost like the subtle sinking that where it's like when you're reading a book but you're not really paying attention to what you're reading.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, it's hard to remember how to make it fresh.
Yeah. And the point that you made about 15 minutes, like I've got giving up chocolate and some negative thoughts about reacting to things, particularly this week with politicians. The 15 minutes is really good and getting up and moving. And I thought, yeah, like even if I've, you know, it's good to stay informed, but if I'm finding reactions, I can actually just get up, switch the telly off and just walk around the room if it's too dark to go outside or I don't want to. But yeah, that's a great tip too that had slipped my mind about that. So,
yes. Yeah. Well, that was a tip to myself as much as anything because of my conversation with my dad, and we just started bagging the whole world, you know, and all the politicians and whatever. And it got so bleak and black that we actually just started laughing and then realised, oh, okay, this is kind of compulsive.
It just so reminded me because I do sort of Sunday catch-ups with my son on the phone. He lives around the corner. Sometimes we get together, but sometimes it's a phone call. And I went, Miffy and her dad, me and my son, and suddenly we're in this space and I need an hour to recover after the phone conversation.
Oh, no.
It's good, but it's like not good. So,
no,
yeah.
There's got to be another way to do it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like directionless chatter. And kind of bagging politics, it's so easy to focus on all of the negativities, but it doesn't help us deal with the negativities. So that's in there. We need that little bit of discipline of slowing it down and then thinking, what could we do? So even if we can't do anything about a politician, there is something that we can do to reflect it in our workplace, say to not have misogyny in our workplace. Bring it home again.
I've tended to bring it into when I'm chanting Chenrezig mantras to just think about that compassion and just putting that out there for people to, you know, take into their heart to think a little bit more about what they're saying, you know. So
And Chenrezig has the thousand arms that encompasses everybody. So Chenrezig's arms can encompass all of them and hold all of them with his eye of compassion.
So the challenge is not to exclude them and do an us and them. It's like, no, you don't deserve it. It's like, no, we're all in this.
Well, that's right. See, what would Chenrezig do? Chenrezig would hold Donald Trump to his bosom.
Yeah.
And any other politician that you care to name. I mean, they're thick and fast now. Just as dearly.
Yes.
So even if I can't do that, then I'm going to really rejoice that Chenrezig does that.
That's the one. Yeah. No, this has been really great. Really good.
Well, that's also, it's good to hear, Anne, because it gives me, I'm still kind of rewriting next week's class, so it gives me an idea of what's important for people. So that's good.
Just on the worksheets, I'm still going, like I'm still on page 10 working through, but I found it helpful doing them a little bit delayed because I get some more information, I get some more insight, and I'm able to really make them meaningful. So I'm not kind of rushing those because I can see this plan developing. So, it's really good. I was about to do the one, actually I was going to ask you about that, but I'm glad I left it, how to set your direction for life. And after I was going to do it before we started class, but after we did the class, I went, actually I really needed tonight to do this.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so. And I think we might actually revisit that next week as well too because it pulls it all together.
Yeah, it's good.
So remember, Anne, though, with those with the homework that you can do various sweeps. So you can do the first thought, best thought, just do it easily. And then the ones that are hard, they're in there. You've just read the question, they're in there, and then you just come back to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's homework, but it shouldn't be a drag or stressful, and also to not get too precious about it either.
Yeah.
You can just kind of jot off things, and that's okay. Work in progress.
And that's the thing that one of my less useful habits is this logical. I've got a logical mind, so it's got to go in this sequence. And it was like, well, just leave it blank. So yeah, I have permission now. That's good.
You do have permission. That's great.
Thank you.
And Amelia, so I understand you can't turn your camera on. It's great that you're here. And so Amelia says she got some great pointers, had a question, not so much related to tonight, but in regards to taking refuge vows and the process to do so. So yeah, Amelia, we do try and offer the refuge ceremony once a year here at Lungri Tumpa Centre. It's usually towards the end of the year. But of course, COVID put an end to that for last year. But we will be asking Geshe Saltram from Chenrezig Institute to start coming down and teaching here again. And so then hopefully at the end of this year, we'll be able to have a refuge ceremony. With taking refuge, it's a way of formalising your commitment to Buddhism and taking the refuge vows. So you have to be dead set certain that Buddhism is the way for you, and you need to know what it is you're taking refuge in and what the refuge commitments are. So there is a great site, Burzen Archives. It's called Study Buddhism. And you can find it on our links page. There's on our website, useful links in the resources tab. And the Study Buddhism is one of the weird and wonderful sites that I put up there. So it's an incredible archive, and it will give you a really clear idea of what refuge is and what the refuge vows are. So it's good to do lots and lots of pre-study beforehand, so that the initial urge to take refuge is supported by really knowing what it is that you're committing to. And then stay tuned. I hope and pray that Geshe Sultram will be able to start coming back in person. Okie dokie. And so, Amelia, did you want to turn your microphone on and ask anything, or the chat is fine? It's entirely up to you. Okay, then Mark, how about you? How are you going?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good.
Anything particularly stood out from tonight, Mark?
I'm not particularly trying to break any habits at the moment, so, which maybe is a sign of not appreciating the things I should be giving up. But
you mightn't have any of those really terrible bad habits. So then it's focusing on making the positive habits strong, so that they are more powerful than the negative ones.
But certainly the gratitude journal is a habit I've wanted to do properly. I never managed it. I managed it for sort of 3 days in a row, 4 days in a row, and then it kind of falls off pretty quickly.
So I think actually the gratitude journal practice, it's a little bit more than just what I had of just, you know, a list, the same old every day. There is actually a website, gratitude website, where they've got how to do it as a practice, and it's kind of an ebb and flow. So sometimes you focus on the more immediate things or the physical things, and then other times you go a little bit deeper. You write less on your list, but you get more of the qualities about the thing that you rejoice in. So it's different ways to approach it. Because
that's
otherwise,
just called gratitude, is it? The website?
Yeah, I think it's just called gratitude.org, maybe.
Okay.
Do a Google and see what you can find. There might be a couple of websites, but they have a lot of resources. It's like a non-denominational thing. And they have various different types of journals that you can download to use, you know, templates and an idea of how to put it into a practice that's a little bit different each day. Because like I found, actually the gratitude journal is good to think of those three levels of happiness and make sure you include each of those levels in there. And
I find it hard to find that kind of... I could sit down and do a led meditation, be it through a podcast or whatever. I can kind of do that because it's being led. But actually taking the time to cognitively think about something I'm grateful about, for some reason, even though it shouldn't take any more than a minute, I don't get around to it.
It's because we're not practiced at doing that, and that's why I think writing it down is so much easier, because cognitively we're a culture where we write all the time. And, you know, back in nomadic cultures and things, not very many people wrote things down, so they did it all in their head. But we think by writing. So I think it's worth writing it down. That way you capture it and it's much easier. And then you'll get in the habit of it, and then you'll actually be able to sit there and cognitively do it, and it'll come easily.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because otherwise you need to have that skill of concentration to be able to go through cognitively just in your mind with meditation. And I really think personally as beginners that can be a real trap. So I've found actually even just writing something down, posing a question to myself, what would that be like? You know, if this happened, what would that be like? And then thinking about it in a nice relaxed way in the garden, so that you've left some space in your mind for things to become apparent, And then when a few things become clear, then you write those down and then you ask another question about it and you think about it for a while. So it's kind of a to-ing and fro-ing.
Yeah, yeah. It's finding the time, you know, in the morning, you know, up, trying to get to work, trying to get, do this and the other, whilst I find the time to brush my teeth every morning.
Do you ever take public transport? Do you drive or do you take public transport?
I tend to run or like cycle and stuff. And cycling's a time when you can, running, not maybe, you know, do that stuff.
Because, like, I do my best thinking on the bus.
Yeah, public transport's great for that. Trains are really good for that.
Yeah. So if you can hitchhike it onto something else, that'd be good. That might make it easier.
Yeah, so it becomes part of a habit again.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's not hugely deep thinking that I do on the bus, but, it, you know, the constant movement helps keep you paced.
Yes.
And the slight distraction looking out the window means that my mind's a little bit open and so new thoughts and ideas will come that wouldn't normally come.
Yes.
So maybe you just have to build it into at the end of the cycling, you know, build in an extra 5 minutes to just sit down and write down what you thought about or a new question. Build it into something you're already doing.
So it reinforces that habit.
I often journal things at nighttime, like last thing before I go to sleep, and then I'll just reread it in the morning, just a few seconds when I wake up before I get out of bed. And I find that helps to like set the tone of the day and be mindful of whatever it is. If I'm going into an uncomfortable situation, which often happens at my workplace, to just, I don't know, be a little bit fortified before I go in.
Yeah.
A little bit calmer, perhaps.
And Tracy, also doing that at night, like just reflecting on the day like that, it's really powerful because we do all that processing while we're asleep. So it's kind of like we're doing a whole lot of work without us even having to be awake. And I think, yeah, by journaling at night, just that simple act of reflection puts it all into play.
Yeah, and it makes the positives in the day stand out too, I think, because it's easy to get caught in the minutiae and it's, if you just got five lines that you're going to write, you want them to be more memorable or significant or something.
Yeah, good.
It was interesting what you were saying before about taking refuge. I don't know if you remember, I spoke to you when I came into the Gompa for the beginner's course. I came in with a friend of mine and I was saying to you how I'd been at the Chung Tien Temple for 6 months.
Yep, I remember.
And it was really interesting because I'd only been there for like 5 minutes and the nuns were saying to me, "Oh, are you going to take refuge? You know, you should take refuge." And I'm like, I don't even know what Buddhism is yet, you know. And but their attitude there is that when you take refuge, rather than it being that sort of really deep commitment, it's sort of more of a step along the path, and that it's still okay if you have doubts. They said small doubts lead to small awakenings and big doubts lead to big awakenings. And so they were really had a really different sort of approach to taking refuge, which I never did, but, you know, I just thought it was interesting because I kept saying to one of the teachers, I would feel like I was being an imposter or something, taking refuge when there's things about Buddhism that are amazing, but there's things that I'm not a spiritual person. I don't believe in things like reincarnation and I can't see really that I ever would. And so it feels fake for me to commit to something that I'm not fully committed to.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've got a point. I'm thinking, so when you take refuge, it's in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So the Buddha, his teachings and the spiritual community, and the Buddha as a role model to lead us to our own Buddhahood. So we take refuge in an external Buddha as being inspired by a great, you know, mentor or role model, but the main purpose is to bring forth our own Buddha nature. So it's kind of like having the ultimate direction or safe direction in life. So it doesn't mean that you can't question, doesn't mean that you can bring other information onto the path, but it's like the main direction that the highway is going in is to enlightenment.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the teachings as well. I mean, the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha said to, there's no actually no place for belief. The teachings are to be understood and applied, but just believing in them isn't going to be enough. And actually one of the ways to understand them is by questioning. So I think that's like that, what you were saying about a big doubt means big realizations. So they make a distinction in Buddhism between what's called uninvestigated doubt and healthy doubt, or doubt tending towards the truth. And normally what we have is uninvestigated doubt, where we just can't make our mind up. We just vacillate between is it this or is it that? And that's debilitating, that kind of doubt. But actually questioning is part of the Buddhist kind of approach. But it's quite different from unexamined doubts, just sitting on the fence and not knowing. So as long as you kind of wholeheartedly question things, you'll be right. And then remember, His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, study Buddhism and take up to 5 years to make your decision.
Yeah.
And at the end of each year, check, how have I been applying it? Has it made any difference in my life? Have any of my friends said that I'm a nicer person these days? All of that. And so that you're using your own reasoning and logic, you're checking with your own experience, and you've got, you know, a good few years under your belt, so that it's based more than just on feeling.
Yeah. And lack of knowledge.
Yeah, and lack of knowledge, that's right. So when I took refuge, I was 10. And part of refuge is you take the vows, and so the refuge vow to not harm or kill others, no lying, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, and no intoxicants. So when I took refuge, I took the first three because I was 10 and I thought, well, I don't know what sexual misconduct is, and I don't know anything about intoxicants, so I'm not taking those vows. And then years later, I thought, oh, I should have taken those vows. It would have saved me a whole lot of trouble. But, you know, you can take those vows on the level that you could. And as a very pragmatic 10-year-old, I took those first three and absolutely abided by them ever since then. So, you know, it can be done.
So are you guys all vegetarians or vegans?
No. No, because it's not about diet. It's about actually how we use our body. So to not physically kill others. And of course, everything that we do does directly influence the lives of others. But even like if you're vegetarian or vegan, there's still creatures that die. There's just no way around that. Mm-hmm. There's still creatures that die in the earth from tilling the earth, from making the crops, from transporting things. So yeah, we can go that one way and become like Jainism, of like being able to do very little in life but not harming anybody. So the Buddhism kind of takes the middle way and goes to harm minimization, and as a nod towards the fact that creatures are going to die for our well-being, whether we're aware of it or not, the minimum is part of the practice of refuge is to offer your food. So when you eat, you dedicate directly for every single living being that was involved in that food. not even just that bowl of porridge or whatever, but all the way back in history, inventing agriculture, all the way back to ancient Egyptians and back and back and back. And so you offer for the benefit of all those beings as a way of ameliorating the fact that they die. You know, we're living on the backs of others.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, even just that, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, it's great if you can be vegan, if you can be vegetarian, fantastic. But that's not the meaning of that vow. The meaning of that vow is restraining ourselves from harming others physically.
Yeah.
Mm.
I've been trying to shoof ants out of the sink rather than...
I know. I catch all the little cockroaches in my cockroach piece of cardboard and plastic cup and throw them outside. Fly, be flea.
I've killed a couple trying to save them. Oh, then I've had to do prayers.
Yeah, I know. I know, that's right. And even though, I mean, it can take a lot of time and effort, it is good to have a safe zone. So I just, for the last several weeks, was having this power struggle with the grasshoppers because the grasshoppers just exploded in their population. And started eating everything in the garden. So I've developed this way of being able to catch the grasshoppers because they're actually quite gentle. And if you come up behind them, you can just make them walk into your hand and then close your hand over. And then they just walk around in my hand. And then I take them to the other side of the building and let them off over on those plants over there. So I've caught about 40 now and they seem they're finished. But I got this really nice relationship with them because, you know, I thought they all jumpy and there's sticky legs and whatever, but they're actually really gentle and quite shy. So one, they'll, as I walk along, they'll edge around behind the plant to hide from me. Dip, 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 dip. So, but then I sneak up behind them and catch them. So then it's nice. Then you have a harmonious garden. So no, you cannot eat my plants, but I am going to gently catch you and I'm going to massage you into my hand and take you over to eat the other plants. So anyway, it's 10:35. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Amelia, too, for staying on, and Mark and Tracy and Anne. Wonderful to catch up, and really hope I see you next week. Have a great week. Enjoy just whittling away at the homework.
Will do.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you.
See you later.
Bye. Bye, everyone.